Hi, gang. Ryan and Bev here. Say hi, Bev.
Hi, Bev.
Before we get going on the Hateful Eight, we wanted to warn you that this episode sounds pretty crappy. We apologize for that, but we were trying to fix that inconsistent, robotic, echoey sound we've had to deal with for nearly the entire time we've owned these Yeti microphones. We get better microphones, we've had worse sound, as our regular listeners probably know. We thought the problem might be with our recording program, so we made adjustments and only found out afterwards that it was so distorted. I also didn't realize I was such a heavy breather until hearing this episode. So we'll be using a different program to record in the future, or we'll just sit with one Yeti mic between us for an episode or two until we figure something else out.
But our takes were so hot that we could not bring you this episode.
We also didn't want to re-record. It's holiday season, we're busy.
Our takes were also very long.
All right, on with The Hateful Eight.
So winter is here, people, and what better way to come in from the cold than with a nice, fresh cup of coffee? But you can absolutely not be getting your coffee from Minnie's Haberdashery. First of all, it's poisoned, but second, it's not even freshly roasted. So instead of risking your life for coffee that's not even that good, make the switch to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with fair trade premium Arabica beans. They offer a variety of blends and roasts to choose from, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this fantastic coffee to you in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or you can join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club. It's completely flexible and customizable. It has all the convenience and none of the commitment. And right now, if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug will give you 20% off your next coffee order. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
TOP 100.
TOP 100.
TOP 100.
Project.
And action.
Happy Christmas week, you movie-loving sons of bitches, and thanks for downloading the 373rd Ellis's Analysis, the weekly podcast that digs into movies of yesteryear. If you want to hear us dipping our toes into the waters of the AFI's 123 great movies that they featured on their 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists, you'll have to go back a long way, but all those reviews are there in our archives. They were filled with spoilers. Today's blood-soaked episode will be too. We won't actually be blood-soaked. Might be some blood seepage. I can't promise I won't cut myself, or I'm not going to cut you. That's going too far. Won't announce that to the world. I'm doing such things anyway.
That's your Christmas present to me.
I'm a generous fellow. I'm not a hateful one. I am the bastard who needs to hang, though, Ryan Ellis. And here's the foul-mouthed little lady who would only chop Kurt Russell's arm off if she really had to. My wife, Daisy Dumb and Gray Demergue, whatever. But her real name's Bev.
That's me.
Okay, the coming attractions opinion question. We set this up last week, of course. It's pretty elaborate, but it's all about fellow great directors, some of whom are Tarantino's contemporaries. So The Hateful Eight is arguably Quentin Tarantino's worst movie, this or Death Proof. And of course, that's an opinion. You could say Jackie Brown. Others might really not like Pulp Fiction. God knows. But I think most people would say that either Hateful Eight, Death Proof, in the bottom rung of his films. But it's still pretty good, Hateful Eight and Death Proof for that matter. So let's take a sampling of legendary directors who also have a dozen or so titles on their resume. Stanley Kubrick, Paul Thomas Anderson, so he definitely is a Tarantino contemporary, and I think a friend. David Fincher and David Lynch. David Lynch. What is their worst movie or worst couple of movies, in your opinion?
I'll start with Fincher. I actually had this whole elaborate back and forth about how I came to the conclusion of what Fincher's worst film was, but then we saw Mank, and it's Mank. Did not love it. David Lynch, this one's easy. It's Dune. I don't think anybody...
I forgot Dune. I was going to say Wild at Heart. We did Wild at Heart earlier this year, and that was my easy first choice, but I must have overlooked Dune. But I've only seen that once, and I've now seen Wild at Heart three times and still don't like it, so that's why I said that. But you're right, Dune might be worse. And by the way, I agreed on Mank or Curious Case of Benjamin Button, which is not bad, but I only saw it once and don't care to ever see it again.
I low-key love The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Maybe I should give another chance then.
I feel like people did that movie wrong and it deserves a second look. It definitely deserves better than what audiences gave it, but maybe that's just a taste thing for whatever reason. It strikes a chord with me. I was going to say The Game, which is a movie I like, but I gave it a rewatch recently. Oh, it's quite a bit dumber than I remember. And just as a matter of, well, what's the worst Fincher film? Well, he's never made a bad film, so, yeah.
Most of these people you can say that about. That's why I picked them.
Yeah, the least good film.
The other Fincher one, I said this on the podcast years ago when we covered it, Fight Club is not one of my favorites, but I wouldn't call it bad, nor would I call it one of his worst films.
So moving on, Kubrick. This one was tough. Mm-hmm. Killer's Kiss is pretty forgettable, but it's also such an early film, I don't really feel like it fits into the spirit of the question. Spartacus definitely was floating around there. But I think I get more out of Spartacus than I do from Lolita, a film I have tried very hard to like but always failed. And then I really turned against it once I read Lolita, the Nabokov novel. I think it really fails. I think it lets the spirit of the novel down, which is fair. You don't have to stick with the spirit of the book. But nobody really thinks Lolita is a good movie, so I don't feel like I need to defend it like I would The Shining taking leave of Stephen King's book.
For me, it's Barry Lyndon. Which is beautifully made, but boring as fuck.
I've never seen it.
Another one I've only seen once. Maybe I should see it again. A critic I respect loves it. Jim Emerson.
The one Kubrick movie I've never seen, and I feel super bad.
I agree with you, though. We're not going to really rate his first few films. Of all these people, he's the one that got off to the slowest start of these five names. He'd probably be, well, probably, he would be the greatest name of all of them, except he did get off to a slower start than the rest of them did. Okay, last one would be PTA.
Inherent Vice.
Yeah, I fell asleep during it. I talked about that in other podcasts. Maybe it's good. I should probably watch that again, too. And I didn't love Phantom Thread, but that's one that stuck in my head a little bit more. Inherent Vice, yeah. I remember nothing. Zero. Nada about it.
I didn't love Phantom Thread either. I think I'm coming to the acceptance that as much as I really, truly respect PTA, and I consider There Will Be Blood one of the greatest films of the 21st century, I'm just not a fan. I just don't really love his movies. But I do want to give Phantom Thread another shot. I think that's a movie I'll definitely rewatch. Whereas Inherent Vice, the thought of rewatching it makes my skin crawl.
But my point is that I didn't give it enough of a chance because I was exhausted. I couldn't stay awake. And it may not have been the movie's fault. Maybe it was, but it may not have been.
I was paying very close attention and trying like hell to follow the thread of that plot or just find anything about it that I could care about and get into. But it just wasn't there.
But with these five filmmakers, and I could have mentioned other people in this too, Wes Anderson came up in my mind, Sofia Coppola, who hasn't made that many movies either. But the point was, is anything of all the ones we've just mentioned really terrible? I wouldn't say so.
No, I agree.
I guess talented people shouldn't make something that's completely unwatchable. But then again, I guess I'm saying that some of these really long movies that bored the hell out of me were a bit unwatchable, but still some good things in them, especially Barry Lyndon with its look. I'm sure Inherent Vice was beautiful because PTA is quite a stylist. And Dune was probably fun in its over-the-top way. Wild at Heart had some good things in it. But that was the whole point of this question, because let's get back into the movie of the day, The Hateful Eight, which neither of us loved, and yet it's still very watchable. It is just way too goddamn long and did not need to be in 70mm. There's the podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week. Now, anyway, we'll get into a long one here, I'm sure. The Angry Assholes was released by the Weinstein Company, remember them, 5 years ago on Christmas Day, 2015. It was a disappointment domestically, but the movie did triple its budget worldwide. And what's interesting about that is that you look just domestically, Bastards was a big hit. Django was a very big hit, but it took the foreign box office for Hateful Eight to succeed. This is not a guy who was a big box office producer for the longest time, and this is one sandwiched in there as a bit of a failure in its own way. Just here at home, at least it succeeded worldwide. Bev, please give us the skinny on the Hateful 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, you know, the next number.
It's winter in post-Civil War Wyoming, and a storm is brewing, forcing eight strangers to hunker down in a frontier pit stop for the night. Two bounty hunters, a Confederate general, a sheriff, or is he? A hangman, a cowboy, the shopminder, or are they? And the shackled bounty, Daisy Domergue, or is it pronounced Domingue? Animosity looms as the fragile peace between lawmen and criminals and southerners and northerners breaks down, ending in a very Tarantino-ish bloody massacre.
Or in a nutshell, so every hateful one in the haberdashery is going to die, and I'm fine with that. But what about the horses out in the barn? #SaveTheHorses. They didn't do nothing wrong.
Somebody will come across them. They'll be fine.
It's a bad storm. It's cold. I don't know if anyone's going to cross that quote-unquote road for a long time to come.
Why'd you make me think of that? Now I'm going to worry about the horses.
Because The Nutshell is all about missing the point of the movie. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes number, 74% of critics like this film. So that's a fresh tomato, but for Tarantino, it's pretty weak, like we've been saying. 248 fresh, 86 rotten, for an average of 7.3 out of 10, and 76% of audiences. It was 54th at the 2015 U.S. box office. Star Wars The Force Awakens was number one. Inside Out, which we covered a few months ago, was number four. And Spotlight, the Best Picture winner, which we covered back in February, is number 62. And a little inside dope that pretty much only Bev and I know. Our most popular podcast on our current provider, which has only been a couple years. We were on Podomatic for years. Now we're on Libsyn for, what's it been, about 3 years, something like that, is Spotlight. It lapped The Godfather and then some. And every time I look, it's got a lot more downloads. So I'm glad you guys love that Spotlight podcast. But
really could not have predicted that one.
We did get ourselves out there on other platforms recently, all kinds of things like Deezer and Amazon Music and whatnot. When Chris told me about it for Scoring at the Movies, I did it for us. And our numbers did spike. But especially with the stuff we did this year, and especially with Spotlight. The Oscars for Hateful Eight, it won one of them. Finally, Ennio Morricone got an Oscar. He had an honorary one before that, but now he won a competitive one for his music score, which is pretty good. And the nominations it did not win, supporting actress Jennifer Jason Leigh, and the cinematography by Robert Richardson. No script nomination for Tarantino after many other script nominations, and sometimes wins. And the other award thing I'll mention here is that Samuel L. Jackson, I think this year, I believe this was one of the hashtag #OscarsSoWhite years, was that Sam Jackson was robbed not only of a nomination, but I think of a win. Now, in some ways, that'd be a bit of a make good for the whole career, but especially for his great performance in Django, where I think he should have probably won the supporting actor Oscar, but didn't get nominated for that either. But he is the best thing in this movie, and it's a good cast. You could have nominated a bunch of people if you really wanted to. They did nominate JJL, but I think Sam Jackson is close to his best here. And if you wanted to fix the Oscar So White thing, you didn't have to have token nominations. He should have been in there anyway in the group of five.
Who did win that year?
Leo for Revenant.
It's hard to argue with that win.
No, it's not. You've said it before. He should have won for Wolf of Wall Street.
Yes, but he is great in Revenant, and God knows he worked hard for that. Mm-hmm. And you're right that Jackson probably should have won for Django, but he is so incredible in this film. Mm-hmm. I disagree with you. I think JJL, she really holds her own. I think
she... Did I say she didn't?
Well, you were just saying that he deserves a nomination even more than she does, but I disagree. I think she's fucking incredible in this movie.
One of her best performances in what has been a very good career. Incidentally, before we go any further, I guess I better mention that we got some kind of banging going on out there. It's not a basketball.
It sounds like they're playing basketball, but it's pitch dark out there.
In December.
Our neighbors are making a racket.
It was piano earlier. Well, tomorrow we record, Chris and I do, our Searching for Bobby Fischer episode, and he's got a program that's supposed to eliminate sound that isn't his voice, and we'll see if that really works out well. If it does, I'm getting that too for us, and then people can make whatever noise they want to. Okay, well, this is your third viewing of this movie, my second. We saw it on the big screen in 70mm. Like we saw The Master in 70mm in that same room in Toronto, the Varsity Theater.
And Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Was that 70? Yeah, same room?
Yeah, it was.
Okay, I forgot that was too.
One of the few places, and maybe the only place in Toronto to see a 70mm film.
Yeah, one of the few probably in North America. Mm-hmm. I don't know that maybe more so The Master, but in any case, it needed to be in that format, especially this movie, which is mostly inside. And you could say, oh, you got these great vistas. Widescreen covers that. Okay, fine.
I'm going to argue in favor for it. We'll get
you
to
are.
It. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Your general thoughts on The Hateful Eight, your third viewing, and my second.
So I'll just sum it up by saying, of course, we've done a lot of dumping on this movie already, saying it's one of his worst, but Tarantino films are like a Hattori Hanzo sword. The worst ones are still better than most others. I've still seen it 3 times.
Will you see it again?
Yeah, I probably will. I've seen all of them multiple times. I think the only one I've seen less than 3 times is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, just because it only came out last year, so I've seen it twice. If I were to rank them in order of which ones I want to watch again, do you know what's last now? It's Django. The more I see that movie, the less I like it. I would rather watch Death Proof again. I would rather watch Hateful Eight again than sit through Django.
Which I believe is his most successful film financially. If not number one, then number two behind Inglourious Basterds.
Lots of people disagree with me. And I think there's lots to like about Django. I can't quite put my finger on why it's lost esteem.
The racism, the fact that it's a modernly racist movie, not just dealing with racism in the period it's set, but that it's also arguably a racist movie made in 2012.
I mean, there's a lot of cringiness that doesn't help.
Well, interestingly, this movie is set around the same time frame. Not that far off, anyway. This is set in Wyoming in 1870, so not that long after the Civil War ended. Like you said in your intro a minute ago there, your description. It's also near Christmas. Now, I wrote a note for that, and I don't remember why. Does it say at some point it's almost Christmas?
Yeah.
Gage, it's winter in Wyoming.
I guess
it has to be.
He's going to visit his mother for Christmas.
There you go. So another unintentional Christmas selection here this month. We wanted to do Castaway and a Tarantino movie, because they always do well, and Castaway because we love it, in December, and they both have Christmas themes without being the Gremlins and Home Alone films we also covered for Christmas. This was shot in Telluride, Colorado, so yeah, the place that does the film festival. Some of it's in L.A., I think probably the interiors, at least some of those were. Some of which apparently were refrigerated, so they cooled it down to basically 0 degrees.
See their breath?
So you could see the breath like they did in The Exorcist and some other movies, but you can do that digitally so much now. We talked about Fincher not that long ago, and he did that very infamously in The Social Network.
And it looked bad. It looks better when you do it for real. I'm sorry, that is one thing special effects has not nailed yet.
This movie actually froze the actors. They're wearing heavy coats, at least, for pretty much the entire movie, so they could have been too cold. But regardless, they worked in some legit cold conditions. And it's funny coming off of... Well, Bastards wasn't the previous movie. That was Django. But I'm thinking of the fiery scenes towards the end of Inglourious Bastards, where Eli Roth and Omar Doom nearly died in a fire. And now you've got a movie that's so much about the opposite. Deadly cold.
As much as I love Tarantino movies, I bet working for him is a total nightmare, and he will do anything to get the shot.
I don't think so. It sounds like he works so well with the actors. They love the dialogue he writes for them. I think he's collaborative. I'm sure it's that this is the dialogue, and you're going to say this the way that the Coens do it, the way that Kevin Smith apparently does it, and many other directors. But I think in the end with Tarantino, from what I've ever gathered about it, is that people don't mind being pushed because he's not, we think about the Kill Bill stories, where this obviously isn't true, but doesn't push them too far. The stunts with Uma Thurman, she got hurt. We know about that. Okay, so generally, I don't think he pushes them too far. Then again, he almost killed Eli Roth and Omar Doon.
Yeah.
I guess my point is I've never heard anybody say, other than Uma Thurman, that they came out of this feeling that they wish they hadn't worked with them, or they're frustrated, or they won't again. This movie, for example, is jammed with people that worked with him before and have again since in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That doesn't mean that they love working with them, but I would say that tends to suggest that exact thing.
Okay, you're right. I think I just read a lot of stuff about how he insisted on shooting at 70mm, and he insisted on doing the color pass in 70 as well, and I just thought of these poor assistants doing an A-B cut for the first time in 20 years, and how he seems uncompromising and everybody thinks he's a hero for it, but when I think about the logistics of him getting his way sometimes, as a person who works in TV mostly, but... people like him can be such a goddamn headache to work with. We know that Uma Thurman got hurt because she took chances she didn't want to take because he pushed her. We know that he likes to choke his actresses personally. We know that he almost got Eli Roth and who's the other actor?
Omar Doom.
Yeah, burned alive. A certain invaluable prop got destroyed in this movie. He was thrilled with the result because it actually does make for an incredible take acting-wise. The guitar that Daisy plays that gets smashed by Kurt Russell is a legit, authentic, antique guitar.
It was tens of thousands of dollars. That's how much it was worth.
Well, it was insured for $4,500, but they got $400,000 for the replacement in the end.
Okay.
Because it's 150 years old. There is no replacement. And it was on loan to them from the Martinique Museum. They did have these other guitars that Russell was supposed to smash, but... nobody told him or something, and so he just plucks it from her arms and smashes it. And when you see her reaction, which actually seems a little out of character for Daisy,
because she's looking off camera, I think she's looking at Tarantino probably, or maybe it's the person that brought her the guitar seconds before,
and she's trying to stop him like whoa.
Yeah, and it feels like that's a bit of a hard cut because I think they had to get their scissors in there at the point where she probably said, shit, guys, Kurt just broke the actual guitar, because yes, she is out of character looking off camera.
And she was playing the actual guitar, so she was being very careful. She was told how valuable it was, and so she was being very precious with
it. He is the opposite, which is completely destroyed.
And then he just plucks it from her arms and
which he was supposed to do, but not with that one.
Everybody on set was really upset about this, but Tarantino had a little smirk on his face. Yeah, this guitar was destroyed, but didn't he get a great take out of it? And that just feels like it kind of sums up Tarantino's attitude, that he really does care more about his work and the output than he does about anything that happens to the museum that lent them the guitar, to the actress that got hurt in a car wreck.
This reminds me of two things, one of which you're going to argue with me about, and we're going to have a longer podcast than I intended, but I'll say it anyway. The first one, Michael J. Fox said that Robert Zemeckis told him in Back to the Future that pain is temporary, film is forever. So if you have a headache or a little bit of a wound or nothing all that serious, then who cares? Let's get the damn take. I wouldn't say Zemeckis was pushing Michael J. Fox too hard. I think it was more about sleep.
Yeah, because he was moonlighting.
On the first movie. And then they made the second and third together. So then they worked their asses off even more with that one. The second one plays into a bit of what's been going on in the Me Too thing in Hollywood. Not excusing, because of course the producer of this movie is Harvey Weinstein. The worst of all, maybe. But when you hear stories from people about how they were this, they were that. Filmmakers, probably directors, especially the auteurs, have been told they're great for 20 plus years at the point that Tarantino made this movie. So a lot of things that they've said or done in their career, and again, I'm not excusing it, have been shitty because they are that obsessed with getting the shot. When you talk about abusiveness on set or the Uma Thurman thing and the Kill Bill films where she got hurt, or so many other films where people got hurt, it isn't cool, but these guys get tunnel vision, and partly because any director, but especially an established one, especially a superstar, is told the movie's all about what you want, Quentin, Steven, Marty,
Stanley,
Zemeckis, Fincher, Lynch, all these people we've been talking about today. And I'm also thinking about David Lean on, I think, Dr. Zhivago, one of the train scenes, I think it was. Somebody got hurt, but they got the shot he wanted, and then that person, I think, later did die or something. And David Lean didn't act like, oh my God, I have to change my ways. I don't think he didn't care, but it's just that he had complete tunnel vision. So I brought up the Me Too thing, and that's not really what this is, I know, but this is what Hollywood is. And Tarantino's been put on this pedestal for going on 30 years. From what I've ever seen or heard from him, he seems like he's still got his head screwed on relatively right, but I don't think any film director with his renown and fame is seeing the world like everyone else does. And he doesn't care about the money because Harvey's going to pay for it, because his movies don't cost that much to make. And they have recently, at least the last 10 or more years, made a bundle.
And let's face it, his movies probably make a lot in the aftermarket as well, because DVDs, Blu-rays, they're the type of movies that people own. So that's a market that never really gets addressed when they talk about box office sales. Yeah. People are still probably buying copies of Pulp Fiction.
Even now. So I said Me Too, and maybe that's the wrong comparison to make.
Yeah, it's not a Me Too thing. I 100% agree
with you. But one of the reasons why Me Too ever happened in Hollywood specifically is because I got away with it this time and that time and that time. I'm going to push it further and further.
Because of the tunnel vision of their egos and what they want versus the tunnel vision of being an artist who's determined to get the shot, make the film exactly how they want it to be made. These are different motivations. And yeah, I do consider the auteur's motivation to be a more honorable motivation than the rapist. Tarantino is not as bad as Harvey Weinstein by like a lot. All I'm saying is, I bet he's tough to work for. Listen, being in a Tarantino film would be pretty awesome. And I understand why people would put up with a lot. The safety thing, I just find absolutely unforgivable. There's no excuse for
it. You know what's worse than that from Tarantino's point of view? The guitar thing included in this, that's not safety. There are so many people on set with authority beyond the director. The first assistant director has as much power as anybody on a set. The producers. Tarantino's working with Stacey Scheer again, who produced Pulp Fiction. She, I think, is in, or was, in Danny DeVito's production company back then. Richard Gladstein worked with Tarantino at least a few other times, including, I'm pretty sure, in Reservoir Dogs long ago. And then Harvey and Bob Weinstein were executives. They may not have been on set. But all of them have power. Maybe at least some of them were on set. You would think generally it's mostly one set. I'm not excusing Tarantino, but there's a lot of people that could have stepped in. But maybe they feel like they can't tell the artiste what to do as well. Maybe that's part of the problem here too.
Yeah, he is at that level as a director. People are probably afraid to say no to him, which is probably another reason why this movie... There's two different cuts of it. The one that we saw, because we saw the 70mm cut, was over 3 hours long. That's partially because they have an overture and an intermission, but it's also just longer. There's just shots in that version that aren't in the home version. But even the home version is, what, 245?
Yeah, 248-ish.
It doesn't need to be that long. No. That stagecoach scene in the beginning is twice as long as it needs to be. I understand that his editor, Fred Raskin, doesn't call the shots with him the way that Sally Menke... I say this all the time, every time we talk about Tarantino. His films change when Sally Menke, his regular editor, died.
So after Bastards. That was the last movie she cut for him.
The last film they made together was Bastards, and then Django, and every film from then on was cut by her assistant, Fred Raskin. He is obviously afraid to tell Tarantino no, or maybe he's just not as talented as Sally Menke was. Sally Menke was with Tarantino from close to the beginning. I don't think she cut Reservoir Dogs, but she cut Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, she was nominated for that, I believe.
Right. She just probably had the guts to tell him no in a way that
or maybe more importantly to show him no. Here's what I think we should do, Quentin. Oh, you're right, Sally. Okay, yeah, we'll do it that way. They don't get to Minnie's haberdashery, our main characters, because we'll talk about the other characters later on. But Kurt Russell, Sam Jackson, Jennifer Jason Leigh, and James Parks don't get to that haberdashery to the 35-minute mark. Some of the exposition on that stagecoach is necessary. I didn't mention Walton Goggins, of course, probably the second main character in a way behind Sam Jackson in this movie. Do a lot of talking. Some of it's needed. But 35 minutes worth of it?
No.
The whole buildup when we first meet Sam Jackson is cool, and maybe the idea is let's have all this tension. But then we know that Sam Jackson's not going to kill Kurt Russell. Well, maybe he could. But not likely to kill Kurt Russell in the first, whatever this is, 15, 20 minutes of the movie. Let's watch him put the guns over on the rock, walk all the way over there and all the rest of it. And the funny thing is, and maybe this is supposed to be an intentional thing. I guess it is. Tarantino is usually a pretty careful filmmaker and astute. John Ruth, Kurt Russell, turns his back on Major Marquise Warren at one point when he's had all this distrust of him. Maybe he's starting to believe who he really is. He's racist. He throws around the N-word a little bit, not as much as other characters do. But after all of this buildup with, okay, well, you put those guns over there. I don't trust that you're not actually going to try to shoot me, when he has no reason to think that. Although he could be ambushed. And that is what the plot of the movie ends up being, is that it is an ambush, mm-hmm. just not there, not on the trail. But all that buildup, and then he turns his back on him, which I thought was probably intentional. And if so, a bit of a clever moment. But so much of that doesn't need to be in there. The amount of time they spend on the stagecoach, all of them talking, some of it's needed.
Back when Tarantino was much more lean and mean, you know, in his earlier career, he would have done all of that work, all of that character development, all of that introduction of conflict. He would have done it in the 3-minute car ride, the Royale with cheese scene. How long is that scene? And how much do we learn about our characters in that scene? The foot massage thing. That collectively is a fraction of the time they spend on that stagecoach. So much more economical. How much do we learn about our characters in the 5 minutes of Reservoir Dogs that they spend having a conversation in the diner? How much exposition is there? How much scene setting is there? And it's so much more economical. I think he just, in his old age, is getting indulgent.
We don't find Kurt Russell or Samuel L. Jackson, Walton Goggins, James Parks, JJL. None of them on that stagecoach or the horses are foot fucking masters. Got my technique down and everything. Don't be tickling nothing. You're right. Yeah, he is trying to get everything in there while he still can. He does not want to make movies until he's 65, 70, 80 years old. He turned 57 this year, and he wanted to stop making movies around the time he got to this age. He said that many years ago.
Do you believe it? Because I'll believe it when I see it, that he's going to stop making movies.
If anyone ever would stick to their word about this, it might be him, because he talked about it so much. And he's also said, it's not like I'm not going to do anything. I can still write novels. He could still write screenplays for other people maybe and say, you know what? I won't love that you misdirect this. You know he's going to think that whether he says it or not about even his friends. If he gave a script to Robert Rodriguez, he'd still say he didn't do it right in his own brain and to his wife, maybe not to anyone else. You know in Hollywood, they all think that. They didn't do it right. Writers say that all the time, that somebody messed up their screenplay.
And back when he said he was only going to make, what, 10 films?
This is supposed to be the 8th, by the way. It says in the opening credits. It's the 9th. Kill Bill's 2 movies.
Oh, sure.
I hate that stupid thing with him, but anyway. He hasn't made 10 yet, is the point. No, sorry, he has. Hollywood is the 10th movie, ninth movie, according to his filmography.
Yeah, so he has one movie left. His next movie should be his last movie, according to him. But when he said that, how young was he?
I think it was when he was promoting Bastards, and that was over 10 years ago.
Wow.
Maybe it was Django.
He'll do something, as you said. I mean, this was supposed to be a novel. He originally was going to write Hateful Eight as a novel. It was going to be a sequel to Django. But then as he worked the characters, he just decided that he couldn't do his ideas with the Django character, and the Django character turned into Marquis.
And also this was leaked, and he went off in a bit of a snit. Well, I'm not going to make the movie then. I don't really blame him, actually. I don't mean to mock him for that one, because that would be frustrating. That is why, especially say a Marvel movie character, if you are going to be in one of their films, maybe if you're even one of their star players, you don't get to just walk around with a screenplay. They don't want to trust anybody. I think with Tarantino especially, I'm pretty sure Hollywood was like that. I always shorten that to Once Upon a Time Hollywood is just Hollywood. I read somewhere that DiCaprio and Pitt had to go to Tarantino and read it in his place or an office or something like that, and then leave. You read it. I don't think they read it together, but then you leave the screenplay there. Even those guys he didn't trust not to leak, and they've become, I think, friends to him. So he's not going to do that with just anybody, whether it be producers or money men or other actors. So once it got leaked, he said, well, I'm not making this movie anymore. But I guess they did a script reading or something like that, and it went well. And Sam Jackson convinced him it went so well. Sam saw the potential for his own character. Who can blame him? And he was right. So I'm glad that Tarantino made the film in the end. And I don't really care that much if the ending had gotten leaked. Because if you pick up what's going on, and maybe I heard this before we saw the movie on the big screen all those years ago, But if you pick up what's going on as the movie is playing out, you see that it is Reservoir Dogs and The Thing. And Tarantino has literally said that it's a play on his own movie, Reservoir Dogs, and the great The Thing, with Morricone doing music in that and in this. Morricone's score was Razzie nominated for some reason in The Thing. And of course, Kurt Russell's the lead in that. And he's technically the lead in this, I think. Well, no, the billing is Sam Jackson, then Kurt Russell, then JJL. So he's the second lead.
You think he's going to be the lead, but then he dies before the
Which
last
is a good
act.
Little twist, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's the tie-ins of those movies where if you pick up on that as you're watching it or just watching the ads or hearing about that, then you probably know that this isn't going to be good for anybody because everybody we care about, only Mr. Pink in all three of these stories, The Thing, Reservoir Dogs, and The Hateful Eight, survived, and even he is going to jail.
Tim Roth is in both Reservoir Dogs and Hateful Eight, and in both movies he gets shot in the gut and is slowly bleeding out. He gets shot dead in Hateful Eight, whereas he's still technically alive at the end of Reservoir Dogs, right? He might get shot by the cops?
No, I just said in Reservoir Dogs he gets shot by Mr. White, and that's why the cops shoot Mr. White.
He's killed dead in Hateful Eight, but in both movies he spends a significant portion of the movie
writhing on the floor
in pain because he got shot in the belly.
Gut shot, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you were talking about Morricone, probably one of my favorite film composers. And he used leftover tracks that he wrote for The Thing that never got used, ended up in Hateful Eight. Tarantino has admitted that he took a lot of inspiration from The Thing. He also took a lot of inspiration from a Western called The Great Silence. It's a spaghetti Western that Tarantino loves. They're both bleak, really violent films set in snowy, cold landscapes. A group of bounty hunters brought together by fate. They both start with a stagecoach, and that movie has an Ennio Morricone score.
I also wondered, I didn't read this, if he was influenced again by one of his favorite movies, Rio Bravo. That whole trapped inside kind of element. But maybe even more so, especially with Channing Tatum in the basement the whole time and coming out of that hole in the floor trapdoor. Evil Dead.
Oh, I was thinking of Inglourious Bastards. Shoshana trapped under the floorboards watching this whole thing take place.
This movie is more insulated, or isolated, I guess, too, and truly trapped than The Thing. Or Reservoir Dogs, though, in a way, because Reservoir Dogs, they could go somewhere. The Thing, they can't. But The Thing is a big complex. This is one room. One thing I wondered about watching this movie both times is that when things were happy and things were normal with Minnie and Sweet Dave and everyone else that's there, and they have guests sometimes, like Bruce Dern's character is a guest, where do people sleep?
There's a bed, obviously.
I know, but that would be for Minnie, I would think. But she's also with Sweet Dave, okay, so they sleep together. But what about the young black girl that's there? What about the Colonel character? What about other people that would stop by there who aren't out to kill anybody or ambush anybody that need to stay? Did this have to sleep in a chair, I guess, all night long?
It's the frontier. I think you just rough it.
Okay, maybe so.
Speaking of the haberdashery, let's talk about the set design and just the whole look. I think more than any other Tarantino film, he really put so much love and care and attention into the production design. I mean, he does with every film. But the haberdashery especially is just so rich and full of details. And here is where I'm going to come to the defense of the 70mm film. Even though it's an interior film, almost all of it is set in one room, like a play. That room has so many details, and there's also so much background action that takes place. Having seen it three times, too, as you then start to pay attention to background elements, to performances that are taking place in the background. And those are all details that are just easier to make out when it's 70 millimeters.
Did you notice anybody, I guess it might be Michael Madsen, going over to the pot of coffee during the confrontation with Sam Jackson and Bruce Dern and putting the poison in the coffee?
Every time I get so captivated by
Jackson's
story that it doesn't even occur to me to look and see who's poisoning the coffee. Maybe this shot exists. And there is a shot of Madsen poisoning the coffee.
Well, it'd be subtle.
But I feel like it's a lot of close-ups and flashbacks.
Oh, and to be clear, you see somebody putting something in the coffee, I think, during that sequence, or maybe
well,
it's just a flashback.
Well, you see the extreme close-up, but I mean, like, you see close-ups of Jackson's face and Dern's face, right. And then the flashbacks are intense.
Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about when he has that monologue or that conversation with Dern, it's mostly the two of them for a good long stretch, and everyone else is just listening, including John Ruth, who thinks he's in charge in this room, although we know he's not. You didn't, but I wonder if anyone else has ever looked for somebody moving the background because of what you're talking about now, Michael Madsen, or Tim Roth, or whoever, that was at least in some ways creeping over to put the poison in the coffee.
I'm sure that people have gone frame by frame. That's my defense of using 70mm. The wide shots just give the wider berth to the actors.
I just don't think it's necessary.
It's indulgent. I'm not going to pretend that it's not. They released it as a road show.
Yeah, right. Which does not happen anymore.
A road show. Well, it happened 5 years ago, and I guess it happened 2 years ago.
No, I mean, it doesn't happen commonly anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
The era that he is lionizing, and probably always will when he was a kid, is gone. We've seen it this year. Christopher Nolan is all pissed off, and I don't blame him to some degree, about what Warner Brothers is going to do next year with a lot of movies. And it's not even one of Nolan's films. He's not even involved, unless he's a producer on something I'm not aware of. He's not directing anything. Tenet got released theatrically as much as it could be in what has been a complete shit show of a year, especially in America, which is not the number one market anymore. That would probably be China, and it probably will be long term. Theater going may be... probably never gone, but greatly diminished, especially in smaller markets.
It will never be.
But it's way different than it ever was before, and it probably will remain that way because people, if they didn't already, have discovered, I can watch this at home, if not for free, not that expensively, especially if you have a bunch of other people over, just your
family.
That whole Mulan thing for families was a good deal. If you and I had really cared about seeing Mulan, it's not a good deal. It would have been $15 per person for us to rent it.
That's what we would have paid to go see it at a theater.
True. Okay, fine. But not a great cost to pay for home viewing. So Nolan and Tarantino and these other people that are working, I'm sure Scorsese is, pissed off about the way things are going this year. First of all, guys, no one fucking chose this. I don't think Warner Brothers should have had it be the whole next year's slate is going to be only home viewing. Because hopefully America finally solves this problem by the summer and you can have regular life again, maybe by the summer, maybe even before. But Tarantino and Nolan and a lot of other people are still these holdouts. I think Spielberg, too, not as vocally as them. The things have to be the way they always were. I love looking back at my past all the time, but move on. Especially Tarantino. You're an old man now. You're getting close to 60. Things change.
And people who really are cinemaphiles and want to see it in a theater, I love seeing a movie in the theater. I am going to keep going to movie theaters, even though it's expensive, even though it can be a pain in the butt, and it's always going to be easier and cheaper to watch it at home. I'm still going to go to the theater. I love the theater.
Well, when a Gravity or a Interstellar, probably the Tarantino films if he keeps making them, we will make a point of seeing those on the big screen because we live in a big city. There will always be some theater to go to.
And I think objectively every movie is better in the theater because every movie is better when it looks exactly the way it's supposed to, when it sounds its very best. And more than anything,
no distractions.
When you are committed to sitting down and watching a movie in one go, hopefully not going to the washroom and getting up for snacks or talking to each other, you and I are super guilty of that. When we're watching a movie at home, we'll talk over it.
Yeah, and that's different when it's just the two of us.
It does take away from the experience of watching a movie. There's a lot of motive to keep going seeing movies in theater. But I think also people need to accept that the home movie experience has come a long way. In the last 20 years, it has advanced more than the 50 years prior to that. Home screens and audio are not comparable to seeing it in the movie theater, but they are head and shoulders better than they were back in the old cathode ray days.
And the bigger issue that these guys, I think, need to realize is that people are going to see their movie, barring the kids that go to see something they love 10 times in the big screen, because I guess people still do that. They're going to see the movie more often than not on the small screen anyway, whether it be the TV that I'm facing right now that's 42 inches, which is not that big by home movie standards, or they're going to see it on an iPad, or a phone. And you may not like that if you're Tarantino or Nolan or Scorsese or whoever else, but that's reality. Anyway, let's move on. This podcast is way in and we still haven't really covered the movie that
really
much.
Really got in the weeds.
So the opening credits, they do show a snow-covered Jesus nailed to a cross, which is a hell of a great image with the Morricone music playing. JJL is strung up at the end. Had to be a deliberate touch, right? Mm-hmm. She's not a Jesus figure exactly, but she effectively is being crucified. Hung up, I guess, not crucifixion, but you know what I'm saying, that one guy was tortured and died hanging high in the air, and now she is too. And as we
said, are you calling Daisy Jesus?
No. But there is that visual comparison, at least, not a story-wise comparison. And as we said, this is a Christmas time frame film.
The coincidences that take place in this movie are pretty outrageous, but I think that the notion is that all these people were fated to be in the same time and same place, and that religious symbol is kind of setting up that theme.
So through the whole film, as long as he's alive, which is not that much past the halfway point, John Ruth, Kurt Russell's character, beats the shit out of Daisy many times. Other people do too, but especially he does. And abusing women is awful, but then she is awful. She's supposed to go to hang. She's done awful things. He just likes to make sure, because he's hangman John Ruth, that they actually hang. And she does hang, which of course is a good touch by Jackson and Goggins to make sure that happens. But also through the film, when they get into the haberdashery especially, Daisy and Ruth, John Ruth, have to work together a lot. They are chained, so she literally has to help him out because, and he's also telling her to. But it's funny how much they do work together pretty well, nailing the door shut when they have to do that. We find out why that was like that later on. But she may not be so cooperative if her buddies weren't already in the haberdashery, including her brother underneath. He probably should have froze. I'm sure it's cold in there in the first place because that fire is not helping the whole room that much during a storm, and it's not the best sealed room, if you will. Channing Tatum should probably have been coming up saying, I was there, but it's where they were my sister. But anyway.
You can see the snow coming through the walls and through the roof.
And he has no fire helping because he's underneath. But maybe that's why she's as helpful with Ruth and confident and laissez-faire as she is, because it doesn't matter what you do to me unless you decide to shoot me in the trail and I can't control that anyway. My guys, including my brother, are going to kill you and take me out of here anyway. So why not help you out with this right now? Because I know the basic storyline and you don't.
One of the things that Tarantino experimented with in this film, for better or for worse, is that there's no protagonist, and he makes the audience shift their loyalties as the film goes on. She's the only woman in the film, except for Minnie, who's in it for minutes.
Only young girl, too. And also Zoe Bell. It was a fair amount of dialogue.
Yeah. Okay,
so there's four women, but only one woman in the main story.
She's the only one, and naturally your allegiances are going to lie with a woman in this circumstance, and she's the underdog, and he punches her pretty early on. Initially, you think he's going to be the hero, and then he punches women.
She's slightly sassy, and he just elbows her right in the face.
It takes the film a long time to show us why we shouldn't be on her side. By the time they show the flashback of the haberdashery just being obliterated by the Domingue gang, which is where your allegiances should shift permanently, they absolutely slaughter those perfectly innocent, happy, lovely people for no reason other than they need the haberdashery for their plan to work. By the time they get to that, the film's more than halfway over.
Mm-hmm.
I will confess, it's hard to watch Daisy just get punched in the face over and over.
She's great in this.
She is so great. I've talked before about how radical it feels to watch a woman, especially, be so comfortable with the most disgusting shit that she's mm-hmm. comfortable with in this movie, that she's covered in food and blood and God knows what else, and she just lives with it on her face, in her eyes, the way that she so casually treats her own safety and her own future. It is captivating to watch, and it is hard not to side with her, but then she'll drop the N-word, and it is like whiplash. And that's true of all the characters. You're on Marquis's side, you're with Sam Jackson, and then he tells this elaborate story that either is true, and that he is a rapist who tortured a man to death, or it's false, and that he's just a son of a bitch who told that story to an old man about his dead son so that he could convince him to pick up his gun so that he could kill him. Either way, he's a son of a bitch.
He is a bastard.
He's a bastard. They're all bastards. Tarantino has said, I wanted to make a film with all bad guys. You don't get to side with anybody, and they all die at the end. So I guess justice is served, whether it be frontier justice or real justice. It's frontier justice, but everybody gets theirs in the end.
The most likable characters in the film do have smaller roles. Forgetting the black kid, Keith Jefferson, Charlie. Forgetting him for a second, and the young black girl. Because they don't really have that much dialogue. We don't really know who they are. I shouldn't forget them. But I'm just saying that we know Zoe Bell. She's been in other Tarantino movies. She was the star of Death Proof. She was really good in Death Proof, actually. And she's been a stunt woman for a long time, including for Uma Thurman, especially on the Kill Bill films. She has plenty of dialogue. She's murdered awfully. And so is James Parks, who plays OB, the driver. So the quote-unquote drivers...
Stagecoaches. Six host Judy.
Right. So Judy and OB are the two most likable characters with any real development of the supporting characters. And they're killed awfully. OB, just like Ruth, dies because he drinks the coffee. And Judy's a sweetheart of a person, just doing her job, and she dies too. So they're the good people, as are everybody in the haberdashery, granted. I'm not trying to exclude them. So you say about no heroes or no good guys. Well, we do have probably five or even six good people who've done nothing wrong at all. And even Bruce Dern's character is caught up in this. It's either I agree to go along with this, or the Domingue, whatever the pronunciation is, those guys kill me right here and now. But then we find out his backstory, where
his
he was a racist from the South, because of course they separate the rooms, South and North. And the Southern, if you will, the South Side people are way more casual about throwing around the N-word. There's a lot of N-words in this, not as many as in Django, still a lot, but I also think that is period authentic.
Okay, but N-word aside, Sandy, the...
Smithers, yeah, Colonel Smithers.
Colonel Smithers, Dern's character.
Do not demote him, he's general.
He's general, but he was a general who committed war crimes. Marquis says, and he doesn't deny, that he had a bunch of prisoners of war, and he just let all the black prisoners die. Because...
they were black.
He didn't want to waste the time and energy and resources it would take to keep them alive, because he didn't consider them human. Even the whole story about his son, I was kind of like, good. Suffer. He never had my allegiance.
This is why it's okay to be the shit out of Daisy. And it plays into what we talked about, because we haven't reviewed the movie yet. We probably will this year or next year, sometime soon. Once upon a time in Hollywood, when awful things happen to two women at the end, when Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio obliterate the members of Manson's gang that were trying to, or setting out to kill the people in Roman Polanski's house, including Sharon Tate. But those guys, DiCaprio really doesn't have much of a choice. He's shocked by what's happening. Pitt makes a choice. But Pitt beats the living fuck, and his dog too, out of these two women. And think of a moment the last few years, and there are probably others, but not that many, where you're more along the lines of a Rocky, punch the air with your fist type moments, because they earned it. And Tarantino's been doing that for about a decade. He did it, well, it's easy with Hitler and the Nazis. But when Hitler gets eradicated by machine gun and Nazis get shot in the back and burned alive in a movie theater.
And slavers.
What happens to the slavers? Who can feel bad about those people? What happens to the Manson gang? It's not as much in this movie because nobody is, even the Domingue gang that we know of, what they've done, aren't that bad compared to the Nazis, the slavers, and to the Manson family.
It doesn't have the same catharsis.
Maybe that's part of what's missing in this movie, too. You root for Sam Jackson because he's cool, has the best dialogue. He is a black guy, so automatically
he's an underdog.
And this time frame, too, he was an underdog to begin with, as was Charlie, as was Minnie. So well played in a very small role by Dana Gurrier, who was in Django, by the way. But apart from rooting for Sam Jackson for those reasons and Kurt Russell because he's cool and he is doing his job, but he's also vicious and mean, maybe that's what's really missing in this movie, along with the fact that, like this podcast, it's just so long and says so much that it doesn't really need to say. This is an hour and a half, 2 hour story in a near 3 hour package.
Yeah, and like I said, they wait too long to really show us why the Domingue gang deserves everything they get. So you don't get the catharsis of those other movies. I saw more than one review that talked about this film as a misogynistic film. You can attest, I am a hair-trigger, mouthy feminist. This movie didn't set off any triggers
for
me.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think it's sexist. I think Daisy is a bad person who deserves to be hung. Just like the people in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood deserve their fate. Mm-hmm. There are certain things that it would be sexist not to punish women for if they're just as bad as all the male characters in the film. In a way, you could rewrite this film and make Daisy a man, and very little about her character would change. Yeah. And to me, that is feminist right there. The fact that Daisy is so smart. When you actually see all the facets of her character.
She's calculating the whole time.
She's pretending to be like a hillbilly redneck dummy. Then in the last 20 minutes of the film, we see just how clever she is, how she's been outsmarting them the whole time, even when it seems like all hope is lost and her whole gang is dead. And actually, I have to ask you, do you think there's 15 Domingue gang members waiting for them in Red Rock? Do you think it's true or not?
Okay, a bit of a sidebar, then I'll answer the question. Other Tarantino movies we've covered, I think Pulp Fiction is one of the ones we talked about this, where there's so many side quests and sidebars and side thoughts with the characters that he writes, which is one of the best things he does in his movies, especially in Think and Pulp, where you could have a whole other film about that character. But that also raises questions about what's going on in his plot. So before I answer the Domingue, Domingue, okay, let's get that straight right now. She says her own name is Domingue.
It's Domingue.
And I guess Ruth is just, well, he can read, because they spell it online. I'm looking right now. It says Daisy Domingue. That's how it looks. Major Marquis, that's how they say it. But I would think it'd be Marquis.
But he says, Marquise, he says Marquis.
He says, yeah, and I would think it'd be Marquise, maybe, because that's a baseball player, Marquise Grissom, played for years. I think it's the exact same spelling. It also says Sheriff Chris Mannix. So I want to do this one first, then we'll get back to Daisy. Is he the sheriff of Red Rock?
They never answered this question. Is he the sheriff?
He seems, of all the characters, maybe even more so than Warren, to have the most honor. Because he is brutally racist, no different than Daisy is through a lot of the film. And he teams up with Warren, and I think mostly because, he never says this outright, and I'm glad he doesn't, this is the right thing to do. This guy's right. And again, as he says more than once, I almost died drinking that coffee, and you didn't fucking say anything, you stupid bitch.
And his racism seems to me like much more an act of tribalism than an act of hate. He is a Southerner, and so he's racist because that's what Southerners are, and that's who he's loyal to. And I'm not forgiving his racism. Tarantino himself has said many times over that Westerns, part of their job as the genre is to reflect the time that they were made. You could definitely say that's true about Hateful Eight because it is reflecting a time when people are treated according not just to their status and race, but in many ways to their political affiliations. It takes the characters very little time to suss out whether somebody's a Northerner or a Southerner, and to tell everybody who they are, the same way that Americans today probably need to know if you're a Democrat or a Republican before you can really decide how you're going to treat them and where your allegiances lie with them. Now, by the end of the film, Mannix cares much more about siding with a fellow lawman than he does about siding with Southerners.
I think it's also just justice and what he sees is the right thing.
He cares. You're right. I think he's among the most honorable characters. I'd say the three main lawmen, Mannix, Marquis, and Ruth, all three of them are pretty good lawmen. They lie. They manipulate people. They turn the situation to their advantage whenever they can. But yeah, of the three of them, actually, Mannix does the least. Mannix is the face value guy. I think I read somewhere that when Walton Goggins read the script, he asked Tarantino, is he the sheriff of Red Rock or not? Tarantino said, that's for you to decide. Mm-hmm. Never tell me what the truth is.
I think that's a good idea.
And Walton Goggins is a very good actor. And I watch his performance, and he is the goddamn sheriff of Red Rock. I don't believe that he's lying for a second. I think he's the sheriff of Red Rock.
I think after seeing it twice, I have to agree with you now. The first time, I maybe wouldn't have thought that, but I was watching a lot of things in this movie, and one of them was that. Because he is a brutal racist early on.
Feels deeply superior.
And he's holier than thou to everybody in the room, really. It's not just to Marquis, but yeah, I think because he shows his true colors, and it is a little bit selfish in some ways by saying, yeah, but I was about to die and you didn't say anything when I was going to drink that coffee, Daisy, so fuck you. It is partly selfish in that way, but he is not a dummy. I can't trust you. Maybe I can't trust him either, but I more trust this guy who is something I wasn't trusting a few hours ago than you, you fucking asshole over
and
there.
Marquis trusts Mannix first because when he puts the gang up against the wall and he has his gun on them, he says to Mannix, take this gun out of my belt and point it at them. Mannix is like, why do you trust me? He's like, because you almost drank the coffee.
Yeah, reach,
now
for,
I
my,
trust you.
Reach for my dick, basically, by the
way. Yeah, he's giving him a tremendous amount of trust and power in that moment. And that's the moment that Mannix turns and sides with Marquis. From that moment on, they're together. They take their coats off at some point. They're wearing almost identical outfits under their coats. The white shirt, the black vest.
Common outfit, but still, yeah.
Sure, but you know that Tarantino did that on purpose and he knew exactly what he was doing. They start off looking different. They end up looking the same. This great video essay I saw pointing out that because their outfits are black and white, their blood is red, and the blanket on the bed is blue. So it's red, white, and blue. Mm-hmm. As they're reading the Lincoln Letter. We haven't even talked about the Lincoln Letter yet.
Yeah. We'll get to that in a second, but just to answer the part about the 15 Domingue, I don't think so. I think she's bluffing.
I think she's bluffing.
I don't think they need anybody else. One of the nice touches when we see the flashback, what these awful people did to Minnie and her friends in the haberdashery earlier in the day. Not that long before, in fact. It's only a matter of minutes before that you hear the other stagecoach pull up when they've settled things in there with Bruce Dern and whatnot. And Channing Tatum's gone underneath the floorboards. Those guys are tight. Even Bob, Damien Bashir, who's one of the top-billed actors in this movie, actually. One of the many Oscar-nominated actors in this movie. He was in A Better Life a few years before this, or around this time anyway, when this movie came out. He is respected by, well, Oswaldo's not his real name. It's Pete Hickox. One of the many connections of Tarantino is always going to be the names, and that's Fassbender's character in Bastards. His last name is Hickox, and Tarantino said, yes, this would be his something great-grandfather or maybe his grandfather. But on the IMDb, it says Oswaldo Mowbray, and he has the upper crust accent, but then he's actually more of a Cockney, like Tim Roth sounds and Dogs. No, Dogs, he's American, I guess, right? So Pulp Fiction, there you go, when he has the more Cockney accent. And Michael Madsen as well, with Damien Bashir. Those guys are tight. They hug each other before the mission's about to begin.
Look how many chances they take to save just Daisy, right?
No, but I'm just saying the racist stuff. It's interesting that the Hispanic guy is part of their gang, but they don't treat him as disposable because he's not white. He is tight with the gang. But how many other people do you need? That's four guys, including Channing Tatum, plus Daisy, if this had worked. Because in the end, the black guy is not only the hero, even though black people were victimized earlier, three of them, and of course Gene Jones, who's so great in that small role in No Country for Old Men. He's the guy at the gas station when Javier Bardem called it with the candy bar wrapper and everything. People that know that movie know that scene for sure. And he's in this movie as Sweet Dave. Yeah. But the other three people in the haberdashery, not including Bruce Dern as a guest, are black people. So it's awful that they're the victims, which is probably a deliberate choice to make three black people be victims, but just one white guy. Oh, also Zoe Bell. So three black, two white. But then a black man is the hero. And had Sam Jackson and Walton Goggins, but specifically Jackson, not been on that stagecoach, the Domingue plan would have worked. And they would have gotten away scot-free. They would have killed innocent people. And they would have killed John Ruth, who may not be that innocent, but they would have killed him too. And she would have been free. How many more people do you need when you have guys this good? And it looks like she's actually the leader of the gang. Channing Tatum is her loving brother. But I think maybe she's in charge of the gang if they were just out on the trail. At the very least, she's a lieutenant. If she's not the colonel, she's a lieutenant.
It's shocking that they would treat a Mexican like a brother the way that they do. But probably more surprising that a woman seems to have as much authority as she does. Because she's his big sister. She's like, what, 15 years older
maybe more, yeah.
than Channing Tatum? She has a leadership role in the Domingue gang. Also, if you have 15 people, why aren't they just there at the haberdashery?
To make
to
doubly sure.
To give you the advantage there.
Well, of course, they don't know about Warren and Mannix being part of this, so it's just two people. I forgot about OB. They don't have to worry about the driver so much. They just have to worry about John Ruth. As good as he is, they don't even need the four they have to bushwhack him.
It's just a bad plan to split your gang up like that. The 15 other people don't
She's
exist.
Bullshit.
The Domingue gang is dead when she dies. That's the last member.
Well, you see her calculating, too. It's a very interesting moment where she actually is thinking. When Channing Tatum gets his head blown off, he's not in this movie very long. And he was so, in a good way, miscast. Or at least differently cast.
He was a movie star. He's probably the biggest movie star in this movie at the time it came out, especially.
Well, Russell and Jackson... Over their entire careers, probably more so.
Okay, you want to talk about a bankable movie
Well, at
star
that point,
now?
Then, yes.
Yeah.
And that's part of the point. Let's get him in this role that doesn't seem to suit him. It's like when he was in Hail Caesar in a pretty small role. Could have easily been in the star of any movie the Coens wanted to make. Instead, he's got a small dancing role in that film. So he's proving his character chops as well. But when his head gets blown off, you can see the thoughts going through her head. She is calculating a lot of things right there. Maybe she realizes, oh, fuck. These guys either kill me. Because the things I've said to the black guy, the racist stuff I've said to him, and this, what I think is a cop who probably wants to do the right thing, and I'm supposed to go to his town if he is a cop, and he's going to be part of what hangs me. Or I try to turn the white guy against the black guy and have some chance of success, and what have I got to lose? It's lose-lose for her. Well, it could be win if she convinces him.
She has nothing to lose, though.
That's the better way of putting it, yes.
Yeah.
So I think that's what's going on there. So I don't think there's 15 people waiting. I don't think there needs to be 15 people waiting because... Ruth would not have fought off four different people. And of course, the question could be, people might have asked this when they saw the movie or listened to us now, why didn't they try to do this on the trail? There's two answers. One is the Hitchcock answer. Well, of course, you have to have a movie. But no, actually, the better answer in this case is if they had tried to ambush Ruth and the stagecoach, forgetting Sam Jackson and Walton Goggins being on that coach too, you've got to worry about one guy. But what if, in desperation, he says, if you're going to kill me anyway, I might as well kill your fucking sister. So that's what we have to worry about. That's why people, when there's a hostage situation, don't just go in and start shooting because you want the hostages to not be killed. It's the same idea.
Yeah, why it would have been over very quickly had Marquis not been there because they could grab one of those guns under the table, shot John Ruth in the head, and been done with it.
The Lincoln letter's a nice touch in this movie, too. It ends up being bullshit. I thought it was later in the movie that's revealed because I hadn't seen the movie in about 5 years. But it is fairly early on, and I love J.J. L.'s hilarious reaction to that, the way she laughs. One of the reasons why she was nominated, just like that scene you see in the trailer when John Ruth and she are standing towards the door. This here is Daisy Domergue. She's going to the hangman, going, whatever the lines, going to the noose. She does that gesture.
Yeah, she pantomimes it. It's so funny.
But again, you're looking at a character in the movie who is thinking, doesn't matter what you say, John Ruth, maybe minutes, maybe hours, but you're going to die whenever you close your eyes, or maybe even sooner. I might as well do what the fuck I want to do.
She's
because...
cavalier because she thinks she's got this in the bag.
And she, even beyond that, is probably a little bit nuts.
Yeah.
So she's a little bit like the Joker. What have I got to lose? But I'm going to be saved by my brother and his buddies.
So we find out the Lincoln letter is fake pretty early on in the film. It's kind of striking the second or third time you watch it. John Ruth is very upset to learn that he's been fooled. Mm-hmm. Marquis has a pretty convincing argument for why he's lied to everybody, and that is to be a black man trying to make it in this world. You need some kind of cachet to disarm white people. But even though we find out it's a lie fairly early, we don't actually hear the content of the letter until the last thing we see is Mannix reading the letter, even though he knows it's fake. I feel like this is such a beautiful metaphor. The letter itself written by Marquis, is very warm and optimistic, and in film that is incredibly nihilistic.
Yeah.
And as Mannix reads it, he knows it's a lie, but he still takes comfort from the words and their sentiments. It's the promise of America that all this conflict could still result in a country that is united and fair and safe and peaceful. And like the letter, America is a lie. That concept is a lie. But like the letter, people take comfort in the lie, even knowing. I just think it's such a beautiful metaphor. The first time I saw the movie, I don't think I really got the Lincoln letter thing, why they ended on it. And I did have to think about it. It's not the most elegant Tarantino film. It doesn't all really come together, but it's a really lovely way to close it.
It'd be a better way to die than just having it be Bastards-esque, which is, I do believe this may be my masterpiece, when you cut a swastika on a guy's head, which is a great touch to end a film. But as they yank her up and they finally string her up, which is what Ruth wanted to do, because that's what he does. He's Hangman John Ruth. You could have ended the movie right there. That would be the same kind of poetic ending as Bastards had, but also a lot more vicious and mean-spirited. You're right. It's actually an optimistic, hopeful ending. And as you just said all that a minute ago, I am picturing Once Upon a Time in Hollywood again. One of the reasons I like that movie so much is the Margot Robbie performance. The end scene, just when DiCaprio is talking through the intercom to Margot Robbie, who we don't see that much in that movie, especially at that end sequence, it's mostly her voice. And the sweetness of it. And we've talked about this in another podcast too, I think, where I said that the notion that this middling actor maybe is going to get some good roles now, because he is a talented actor. He's shown his chops earlier in the film, months before in the storyline. Maybe Polanski will cast him and Sharon Tate could end up being a big star. She's been saved. But Tarantino's revisionist history was really touching. Things could have and should have been different. And the other thing I'm thinking about when you just said that with the Lincoln Letter idea is that it was written by a guy who didn't know it, but was not long for this world, who was assassinated. Maybe it's a few years later, but not that many months and years after.
Well, it was written by Marquis.
No, but in the storyline, we want to believe something, right? So the reason why do I get touched by any movie? Why do any of us ever get touched by films, especially by fictional films? Because you're in the moment. This is what you want to be. This is what maybe could be, but it's not. And that's the sadness of it. And also a black and a white guy who didn't like each other through the whole film have teamed up to do, well, the right thing might be debatable, but to save themselves at least, to do some kind of justice.
By their definition, it's the honorable thing.
Right, and Daisy's dead. They're still alive, but they're not going to live much longer, especially Warren. He's going to die very soon. But there's some kind of, maybe not hope, because they're going to die.
It is hope. Tarantino makes very bleak movies, and he always gives us a grain of hope to end on, with the exception of Reservoir Dogs.
But even Kill Bill, though, has a hopeful ending with
Absolutely.
The mother and the daughter.
Yeah, she wins. Inglourious Bastards, they kill Hitler, crying out loud. Django makes a horse dance and takes off with his wife after slaughtering all the slavers. These movies are actually, as violent as they are, incredibly optimistic in their endings. Hateful Eight, he has to sneak that optimism in there through that letter, but then it's also pretty bleak when you think about the fact that what he's saying with the letter, sentiment might be true, but the letter is a lie.
Sentiment is very true. Can be, at least.
Well, it can be, but it's not. It's not true of America then. It's not true of America now.
From Lincoln's point of view,
it's wishful thinking.
But what Lincoln was saying publicly, that's what he felt. I don't know if that's what he felt in reality.
Sure, but his dream privately didn't come true.
Mm-hmm.
Hateful Eight very much knows that. Hateful Eight is a movie that came out in 2015 that is really reflecting 2015 in a lot of ways, even more relevant now. And even more relevant, that dream of America is dead. But nobody wants to bury it. So this is the rare Tarantino movie that, even though it ends on hope, it's not a happy ending at all. Even the happiness that you do find in that ending that make it kind of sweet is a lie.
Okay. I think we mentioned all the actors here at this point, but just to breeze through, Jackson made or has made 6 movies with Tarantino, almost always the smartest guy in the movies, great in Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown. We'll probably cover that within the next couple of years. And I said how great he is in Django. Kurt Russell playing the Duke here, apparently a bit of a John Wayne thing, which I think he was doing also in Big Trouble in Little China, has also played Elvis and Santa Claus and Snake Plissken, and didn't work all that much for a whole whack of time there 10 or so years ago. And now he seems to be working a bunch again. He was in Hollywood as well, the Tarantino film. JGL works all the time. Not the first choice for this movie, but the right choice. You hear about somebody like Jennifer Lawrence, as good as she is and was the girl at that point, probably would have been good in this movie, but it's better to have, I think, somebody slightly older. I looked it up, by the way, we were talking earlier about ages. she is 18 years older than Channing Tatum is in reality. And she's probably supposed to be something like that in the movie. Maybe not 18 years, but older for sure.
Yeah, they don't try to young her down. She looks her age, which is another thing that feels radical and cool. She's just a woman with crow's feet.
Walton Goggins was in Django. He's also in Lincoln in 2012, the same year as Django. And he's, I guess, maybe best known or was at the time of this movie for Justified. Now it might be the Tarantino films like this one. Bruce Dern's made 100-plus movies in his career and is still working. He's been in Tarantino's last three and was nominated for Coming Home and Nebraska. Nebraska was a pretty interesting, fun film, which we covered for the Now Playing Project many years ago. I mentioned Bashir, nominated for A Better Life, also played Fidel Castro in Shea, the Soderbergh two-parter many years ago. We mentioned Tim Roth and Dogs and Pulp, the villain in Incredible Hulk, Michael Madsen. You've said before you're not a fan of his unless it's in Tarantino films.
He's only good in Tarantino movies.
So Reservoir Dogs, the Kill Bill flicks, especially the second one.
I don't think he's a good actor. I think he just has a good persona.
The ultimate example of somebody has to be cast right. And Zoe Bell has been acting a lot, especially in Tarantino films in the more recent years. So Quinn, supposedly his 8th film, I think it's actually his 9th. We've covered all of them now except for Death Proof and Jackie Brown and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And we'll probably get to all those before the next couple years expire. I would think the next one to cover would probably be Jackie Brown or something. I don't know. We'll do that eventually anyway.
You guys love to hear about Tarantino films and we love to talk about them.
But he makes extreme violence fun in so many movies, especially in the more recent era since Kill Bill. But I would say it's almost more cathartic in the more recent films than even was in Kill Bill, because the bride isn't happy doing what she's doing. And maybe Brad Pitt and DiCaprio weren't in Hollywood, and maybe, well, no, the Jewish characters were in Bastards, happy what they were doing, I would say. But it's also a bit of a sick happiness. If you were to sit down and interview them right afterwards, calm them down first and say, okay, how do you feel about this now? There's got to be a little part of them that says, I don't want to murder anybody. If it has to be anybody, it'd be Nazis and fuck them. But he makes horrible violence, even against women, fun. And that is not easy. But when you find people as bad as he's had in his movies, that's when it's fun. And I mentioned his producers already, including Harvey Weinstein, who is not going to work with Tarantino, I guess, ever again because of what he did to women.
Yeah, he'll never make another film. Tarantino knows that we all deep down love to watch violence that is titillating. And he finds a way to make movies that let us scratch that itch in the most extreme way without feeling guilty. That's kind of the gift that he gives the audiences. And it's also part of the sea change in his career between Jackie Brown and Kill Bill. How long was that gap there? Like 6 years between those films? And in those 6 years, he became a different kind of artist. You look at so many things about Hateful Eight, the set design, the elaborate blocking and almost theatrical way of it. It's very, very different from his early work.
And also, as I've said before, his films technically are so much more impressive as he gets older, like the Coens, like Scorsese. Dogs and Pulp are okay looking at best. You wouldn't be nominating them for cinematography Oscars like this got nominated, Ambassadors got nominated, and I think Hollywood got nominated. But he works with Robert Richardson all the time, including on this film, who worked with Stone and Scorsese earlier in his career, all kinds of nominations and Oscar wins. We've covered Platoon. We covered Bastards. He's done 6 movies now with Tarantino. You already talked about Fred Raskin, all the Tarantinos since Django, but also cut Guardians 1 and 2 and a Kurt Russell film with some brutal violence. But I do recommend it because it's a damn good movie. I've only ever seen once. Bone Tomahawk.
Yeah, you're always recommending that movie to me, but I'm afraid to watch it.
It was
you also
on,
warned me about it.
Yeah, it's brutal. It was on Netflix. I think it's off there now. Netflix always does that to you. This movie's on Netflix. I bought the Blu-ray because we should have all the Tarantinos, and I think we do now. The composer, we talked about Morricone, the first and only Oscar he's ever won competitively, despite all of his great scores. He's not been nominated all that many times. And again, nominated for a Razzie for The Thing, which is so stupid, but so well known for the spaghetti westerns. We will undoubtedly cover The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly this year because it is 55 years old. Sorry, I said this year, but I'm thinking of 2021 already because we're planning for that at the end of December. So next year, I'm talking 2021, we'll cover that movie. In addition to his music, of course, Bob plays the piano and Daisy plays the guitar. And there are some songs.
Yeah, there's a White Stripes song thrown in there.
Which is Nicolette's. It's anachronistic, I guess.
Yeah.
The movie is 2.76:1, so the super widescreen look. The technicals, I guess you're going to agree, pretty great, except the movie's too fucking long. Should cut it down.
Yes, the technicals are exceptional. He keeps getting better with every film when it comes to that. It's so lush. This movie's his lushest film.
I would say Hollywood is.
Oh, really? Kill Bill is probably his most colorful film. There's something visceral about Hateful Eight. You can feel the cold. You can feel the coffee. There's something but the scene setting in this film.
Mm-hmm. The spark plug coffee. So what happens next? Well, Warren and Mannix make out hard before they die.
Get a little homestead.
Then they bleed to death. Then some poor bastard has to clean up their gigantic mess inside their haberdashery. We talked on Gremlins last week about the mess in that house, which is not in any way the most important thing that happens in that movie, but there is such a mess in that kitchen from those fucking gremlins. And same with this place. Somebody's going to inherit this place, or I guess just take it from Minnie because she's dead. That place needs to be cleaned. And so anyway, so blood everywhere.
I just want to be inside the head of the person that is the first person to walk in there to try and figure out
right.
What happened.
That would be true about
everybody's dead.
The thing as well. You could ask Mr. Pink in Reservoir Dogs what happened. Evil Dead, if somebody ever came across the bodies and everything in that room.
Ash could.
Well, Ash is killed at the end of the movie.
Right.
Again, just think of the first movie, because I know there's sequels. But at the end of that, it looks like the Force kills him, too, the demonic Force. But all these movies, with very few exceptions, everybody's dead. And yes, what happens when you come across that? It's almost like, this is racist, but this was the name of the book, 10 Little Indians. That whole plan is that no one figures out how they all ended up dead on that island. But we find out because of a message in a bottle. Okay, well, epic episode here as we lead into Christmas, so what a fitting Christmas movie. But it does have Christmas themes, it's mentioned, it's wintry, and despite its flaws, it's still a good one. What are your last thoughts on The Hateful 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8?
Probably a little bit funner to talk about than to watch, but I've watched it 3 times, so it can't be that bad.
I'd like to ask you what you thought of the Oscar win for music. Did you like that choice?
I think it was a career win for Morricone.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not his best score. And then music, even with Tarantino, is such a...
Almost always has been existing songs.
Yeah, and he is his own beast. He creates something so brand new with music that it's almost hard to judge. And then you watch movies through that lens of the Tarantino use of music. But I'm very happy for Morricone to finally have won a competitive Oscar.
Sweet touch, too, because he's sitting with John Williams and I think the other 3 nominees. And when he wins, because Williams has won 5 times, they hug each other. Williams must have known him from long ago and thought, you are overdue. Maybe this isn't your best work, but you're overdue. And Morricone gives a speech in Italian, which somebody, grandson, son, wherever he is, translates for us, like Eastwood did when Morricone won the honorary Oscar. He translated what Morricone was saying. It is a different experience to watch the second time because you are looking for subtle hints and moments and clues because you know what Tim Roth, Michael Madsen, Damien Bashir are doing there. And even Bruce Dern, who's not part of the original plan, but he knows basically what's going on because he witnessed it. He could have been killed too. And to watch all that play out is interesting. Tarantino is the narrator of this film too, as Sam Jackson was for Inglourious Basterds. Narrators in his films is a more recent touch as well. And it feels a little bit jammed in there. Tarantino, I guess, had to get somehow on the movie as a character, an actor somehow.
There's a narrator in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, too.
Which is Kurt Russell.
That's right!
Okay, well, have a safe Christmas and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa. But stay home. For the love of God, stay home. How many more times do people have to hear that? It's not going to kill you 1 year to stay home and not see your family.
Just get snowed in at the haberdashery.
Let's hope next spring, or certainly by the summer, we can live normal lives again if we behave now. When we check back in with you next Monday, we'll be just a few days shy of New Year's Eve. So let's talk about one of the most fun holidays of them all. Well, normally it would be a fun holiday, just not this year because we can't be with our friends. Anyway, the movie we'll cover on December 28th does take place on New Year's Eve, and it is Fruitvale Station. 2013, Ryan Coogler, Michael B. Jordan. This has been a very racial year filled with all kinds of racist stuff, especially in America, and this movie deals with some of that stuff, Black Lives Matter incarnate. The coming attraction's opinion question to end the year. Michael B. Jordan has been in all 3 of the movies Ryan Coogler has directed, Fruitvale Station, Creed, and Black Panther. Which of his 3 characters in the Coogler flicks do you like the most? They are very different, those 3 characters.
All right, so for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about Fruitvale Station. In the meantime, check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to us wherever you listen to us. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and/or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles on top of that. In exchange for all this content, please leave us a rating and a review. We're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. To enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. That's all one word. It's TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive, and that gets you a 20% discount.
Ho, 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 motherfuckers. Ho, ho, ho. Tarantino, Christmas. You're looking at me like you don't get it. Well, that's why. For those who don't get it either, Tarantino and Santa Claus, there'd be death and killing. He'd burn up going down that chimney.
Merry Christmas.
And cut.
And cut.